Thank you. So, as Alan said, I too will make some of my thanks this afternoon, but there are not enough words to thank Albert, so let me just mention Albert for initiating all of this and organizing this. It was really, really tremendous. Now, I was going to start my talk, which you see over here, but then I suddenly realized that this talk has only a few things that I myself did. It's going to be a survey of work that started in the 1930s, and I wasn't really old enough to do research then. And after hearing Grzegorz's talk yesterday on DNA, I remembered an old paper that I wrote over 20 years ago that no one seems to quote at all, but I'm really very proud of it. It's a nice little paper, and I'd like to show you the entire paper as a precursor to this talk. So it was a cover paper in Transactions on Biochemical Sciences in April of 1986. The paper was rejected, of course, from Science and Nature, and it's actually a paper in which we show that the golden ratio governs the dimensions of DNA. And I thought that this was actually the way it happened was Grzegorz mentioned that I work with biologists, so this is in the last 5 or 6 years, this is what I think that you meant. But 20 years ago, I also worked with a biologist and we had a joint student, and then I knew even less biology than I know today, which is kind of hard to believe. And they would work usually in my office because I had a nice office, and I would do what in Hebrew we say woodpecking. So, vroom, vroom. So I would be woodpecking and understanding almost nothing. And then at some point I opened my eyes and I said, "Have you guys ever looked for the golden ratio in DNA?" And they said, "What's the golden ratio?" So I explained what the golden ratio is. And they said, "Why DNA?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's the most beautiful, profound, and important molecule ever. And so it must be there somewhere." So once they understood that this was like a ratio, a dimension, a rectangle, they said, "How would you find this in DNA?" And I said, "What I would do if I knew how to do this, well, I would take the width of the molecule, you know, take the extreme atoms, and take one rotation, yeah, of the double helix, and look for it there." And I said, "Furthermore, you have the minor groove and the major groove, so there's also a very natural place to cut this rectangle somewhere in the middle. Let's see what happens." And lo and behold, we found the golden ratio not only appearing there, but so this is the paper. Let me read you the title. The title is "Beauty is in the Genes of the Beholder." And the reason it was rejected from Science and Nature, I believe, is that it was written almost as a parody on the original Watson-Crick paper. So if you've read that original paper and you start reading this one, it says, "We wish to suggest an interpretation of the particular proportions of DNA as found in the Watson-Crick model. This interpretation has novel features which are of considerable historical, theological, mathematical, and above all, aesthetical interest." And indeed, it turns out that the length of one cycle of the molecule divided by the width is the golden ratio, and which is equal to the width divided by the offset of one helix from the other. Now, the numbers are almost exact, and in fact, what we did find later when doing the real work was that they become better as measurements got better. So over the years, this approaches the golden ratio. And this is the entire paper, and we end the paper with the following sentence, of which I'm very, very proud, which is, "It has not escaped our notice that the specific interpretation we have postulated immediately suggests a possible motto for the copying mechanism of genetic material. Beauty is in the genes of the beholder." So that was that paper, and now we can start our talk here. And so I'd like to start out by saying that I'm going to be talking about bad news. And there are a few things here that I've done myself, but there are no names really, so you won't be able to tell unless I remember to mention them. But this is not important because it's really kind of a broad survey. And the difficulty in giving this lecture to this kind of audience is that many people here know almost everything that's in this lecture. I don't think there's anyone who knows exactly everything, so I try to put in some a little more esoteric stuff. But I've also tried to weave in things that make it interesting even for people who are not from computer science or from applied math. So some people will be bored some of the time. I hope not all people will be bored all of the time. That's the difficulty. On the other hand, this is a topic which I love to talk about for the following reason. It's all about bad news. You can't do this, and you can't do that, and this is terrible, and this is even worse than terrible, and so on. And so the reason I like doing this is because I feel on completely safe ground. So I'm a computer scientist. If I were to come here and tell you something that I can do even better, even faster, even smaller, even more powerful, there's always a chance someone in the back would lift up their finger and say, oh, I can do it even smaller than that or even better, because most of us get paid to improve things, to do things even better. Now, I'm going to show you things that are really terrible. There's almost no chance in the world that someone makes a living and by putting up their finger and saying, oh, I can do even worse than that. So this is not going to happen, and therefore I'm completely confident of the, you know, success of this lecture. Now, on a more serious note, why are people interested in this kind of topic? Why do people like myself and other people in computer science spend some of their time, some people spend all of their time, trying to figure out what cannot be done, what the limitations are? There are many reasons for this. I think the main one is intellectual curiosity. Physicists want to know where the universe ends, what are the smallest little tiddlywinks. Biologists want to know the limits of the immune system and so on. And we also want to know what are the limits of our profession. It also has a sociological facet to it. You know, people around my age or more remember the days when being a programmer was is like being Gandalf. You know, you're a magician. You can make a computer work and, you know, ooh, so you can program a computer. And people walked around, if they knew how to program computers, with great arrogance. You know, we can conquer the world. We can have our machines do anything. And in a way, showing that there are limitations makes us more humble. And this is also important. But there is another really profound reason, which those of you who know what I'm talking about will understand immediately. Those who don't, I'll leave it at suspense, and we'll get to it a little later on. And that is, there are ways in computer science of exploiting the bad news for the better. And this is almost unparalleled. I mean, I know in medicine, you inject bad little things into people's blood so that they can overcome other bad little things. But then, if the first bad little things didn't exist, the second ones wouldn't exist anyway, so it's not exactly the same. Here in computer science, you use bad things to do some things much better than you could have done if the bad things didn't exist in the first place, and I hope that's incorrect grammar or whatever it is. And we'll get to this. Of course, this is in the area of cryptography. So let's get on with this story. So let me get the commercial over with up front. So there are two books in which you can read most of the things I'll be talking about. The more recent one is called Computers Limited, but there's a broader and deeper book called Algorithmics, and both of them have recent editions. And so let me start out with a quotation from Time magazine over 20 years ago. This is not from the mouth of a person off the street. This was quoted from the chief editor of a particular software magazine. And this person says the following: put the right kind of software into a computer, and it, the computer or the software, will do whatever you want it to. There may be no limits on what you can do with the machines themselves. There may be limits, but there are no limits on what you can do with software. Now, if I were not a very polite person coming from an English background, I would say bullshit. But I am a polite person coming from an English, so I will not say bullshit. And all I will say is that this is not true. And not only, it's not that this person forgot to read some paper he should have known about that was published a few months ago. This person is not aware of some of the most fundamental facts of his own profession. And this is very sad, and that's why some of us spend some of their time trying to make more popular and more, I don't like the word popularization, I like exposition, try to make these facts more known. Some of the things I'll be talking about today, almost all of them are things that I humbly believe that people should learn in their first year of computer science, first year of applied mathematics. Sadly, people program computers very extensively, and they don't know these things at all. So the background goal of this talk is to give you this survey. And again, those who know a lot of these things, I apologize. I'll try to at least color it with examples. But the secondary idea is to show people who don't know what computer science is that there are many deep facets of computer science, deep, profound, philosophically, technically, mathematically, and applicatively, and this is one of them, the limitations of computing. So first of all, a disclaimer. Just like Alan had a little more fun at the end of his talk, I'm going to try to have a little more fun at the end of my talk too. But until we get to the end of the talk, or almost to the end, I'm not going to be talking about these wonderfully exciting questions such as can a computer run a company, or fall in love, or have a medical diagnosis, and so on. These are interesting questions. They're not analytic. They're not well-defined. At best, they're pseudo-scientific. And you can try to deal with them using heuristics, and you get into certain kinds of soft research, certain kinds of artificial intelligence, although, of course, there are many, many deep and important and profound parts of artificial intelligence, but some parts are less deep and less profound, and these are very interesting, but this is not what I'm going to be talking about. So what am I going to be talking about? This is essentially, this slide is just to set the rules of the game during this talk. We're going to talk about things I'll be calling algorithmic problems or computational problems, where to define such a problem, you have to tell me what the set of legal inputs is. So the set of legal inputs might be the salary tables of all the employees of the University of Rennes. And the specification of the desired output as a function of the input, in this case it might be give me the names and addresses of all the people who make over, whatever, 3,000 euros a month or whatever. And a solution to an algorithmic problem, of course, is an algorithm. Keep forgetting which buttons. And an algorithm, if you know what that is, fine. If you don't, then just think of a computer program written in any language which solves this problem. And in fact, I'm going to be talking most of the time about decision problems. Decision problems are algorithmic problems where the output is just a yes or a no. So don't even give me all the names of addresses of the people who make more than 3,000 euro a month, but I'd like to know, are there any people who make, or are there more than 165 people who make €3,000 a month? And so these are decision problems. This is a special case. And an algorithm, you don't even have to read this, is a solution if, when you run it on any one of these legal inputs, it always halts after a finite amount of time and gives the desired output as the output of the algorithm. So at this point, I have to make an important comment, and that is that some of you, especially those who have less background in this area, might be sitting there thinking, why did they bring this guy from so far away to talk about such a stupidly simple model of computation? I mean, doesn't this guy know about the internet, about distributed, graphical, object-oriented, plus-plus, real-time computing, about embedded, graphical, continuous hybrid systems? I mean, what's this stuff about an input, and then the computer goes do-do-do-do-do, and then it gives you an output? And not only that, I'm even telling you that most of the time I'm going to be talking about decision problems. They don't even give you real answers. They just say yes or no. So what's going on here? Why waste another hour or more listening to this guy? So does anyone want to try to give the sweeping response to that? There is a sweeping response, which is that I'm going to be talking about bad news. And so the simpler the model of computation, the more profound the bad news is. So whatever bad feelings you have as I make progress here, they should be even worse because I'm talking about such a simple model. Had I been talking about a very complicated model of computation with distributed, interactive, embedded, whatever, then you might say, well, you know, but if I'm just working on my computer and I write programs, then these terrible things don't happen. No, they happen even in the simplest of cases, even for decision problems, which just say yes or no. This is essentially the philosophical justification for making things as simple as I can. Wrong button again. Okay, so usually if you bump into someone who cannot solve his or her problem with their computer, so there are all kinds of excuses. One excuse is I'm not rich enough. If I were richer, I'd buy a better computer, then I could solve it. The other is I'm not young enough. This is a very long computation. It's going to take a long time. I don't have the time. So, and the third, of course, is I'm not smart enough. I just can't figure out how to do this. Maybe someone smarter can. And that's fine, but I'm going to not talk about those. I'm going to replace these excuses by a division between problems that can be solved, and if they are decision problems, we call them decidable problems or solvable, versus those that cannot be solved. And immediately, you should be pouncing on me here for at least two reasons. One reason is, what do you mean can be solved versus cannot be solved? Maybe you can't solve. Yeah, I have an IBM laptop here. I don't even know what the model is. T41, I think. So you might say, I have a Cray 798 in my backyard. I can solve it. Maybe you can't solve it. Maybe you just run C++. I have Java plus minus with object-oriented recursive pointers, graphical. And so how on earth are you allowed to draw a line between can and cannot? It all depends on stuff. And the other issue that you might ask about is, are there any things that are unsolvable in general? And so the sweeping answer to that problem, which button is the one that, okay, is that if there's only one fact that you are to get from this lecture, and remember, I'd really like it to be this one, and this is, I think, the most profound fact underlying the entire world of computing, and that is that the set of problems computable on any computational device using any language, using any methodology, is extremely robust. So what anything you can do, I can do, maybe not better, but I can. Anything I can do, you can do, given enough time. We did not limit the time it takes for the computation. We did not limit any other resources. And this is called the Church-Turing thesis, and it was formulated in various forms, or it was established in the mid-1930s. One way of saying this thesis is all computers are equal. And one of the interesting things about it is, one of the most surprising things about it is that this was known in the sense of knowing things of that kind at that time before there were any computers. So the class of problems that are algorithmically solvable, that can be decided or solved or computed on a computational device step by step, hasn't changed an iota since then, despite the incredible advances in computers that we all know about. Wrong button again. So I'd like to give you a first example, because the second issue was, is there anything up in the unsolvable portion of that figure? And you might say, okay, so you're jumping up and down here and you're telling us about this really robust division between can be solved versus cannot be solved. But maybe our friend from Time magazine is right, and anything in principle that can be properly defined can be solved, and the answer is no. And how? And I'd like to give you an example. The first example is rather colorful, and as many scientists like to do, we like to try to lift up the essence of the issue in the most colorful way possible, and this is the example I like to use. So it's a tiling problem, or domino problem, and for the purpose of explaining it, a tile is a 1x1 square with colors coloring each of the four sides of the square. And just to make my life easier, let's say that you're not allowed to turn them around. I could give you a version where this is not a problem. And the issue concerns tiling your living room. And so let's say that you go down the main street of Rennes, and there's this place where they sell tiles, and you walk in because you need to tile your living room, and you walk in there, and there's no tiles with fish and flowers and stuff and rainbows. There's just tiles that look like this. There are several different kinds of tiles, different colors, and by the way, the person in the shop says, I can get you as many copies of each one as you want, but there's only a finite number of tile types. And this guy who runs this store has two crazinesses. One is not very important, as he doesn't allow you to turn them around. So if you buy this, the blue has to be on the bottom, the green has to be on the top. But the really crucial issue is, wrong button again. No. Is that we're trying to tile the living room, and the constraint is that you have to sign a contract that whenever two tiles touch each other, the colors on the touching edges have to be identical. So if you want to adhere to that, fine. If you don't, you can go next door. There are rainbows and fish and flowers and so on. So let me give you a simple example first. Let's say that you walk into the store, and all there is in the store are these three types of tiles. And if I were to give you paper and pencil and say, can you tile any size living room using these tiles, you would work on it for 5 or 10 minutes, and I think most of you would easily figure out the answer is yes. This is supposed to be a proof by picture. It's if you look closely, I'm only using these tiles. I'm not rotating them or reversing them. Wherever there are touching edges, here, 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 the colors match. And if you look, you can see that this is really a periodic tiling. If you want to prove, you can prove by induction that you can expand this tiling in all directions ad infinitum. So that was kind of easy. Now let's suppose that we replace this by blue and this by green. So we exchange these two colors. And now I ask the same question. With maybe a little more effort, you would easily become convinced that this cannot tile even a very small living room. I'm willing to do a 15-second proof of this. You don't have to listen to it. I'll do it fast. Proof. Let's say you can, and I claim if you can, tile number 3 must appear somewhere. Because if it doesn't, let's say tile 2 appears, it has green on the left, so to its left we have to put someone with green on its right, so 3 appears. If you say 3 doesn't appear and 2 doesn't appear, so 1 appears, 1 has green on top, so above it we have to put someone with green on bottom, it can be only number 2, and therefore 3. So 3 appears somewhere. Where does it appear? Somewhere. Let's put it over here. If we put it over here, below it we must put something with blue on the top, that has to be another copy of number 3. Then we have 2 greens here. The only thing we can put on the right is this guy, and then we have a mismatch. So proof by contradiction. If you follow that, fine. If you didn't, no problem. The reason there's no problem if you didn't follow it is because both this example and the previous example were little riddles, like puzzles. Can you do this? You play around with it. You say yes, you say no. We are not interested in puzzles. We are interested in the general problem. The general problem would like to automate the reasoning we just went through in the last minute and a half for these two examples. And we would like to build, it's called the basic tiling problem or the basic domino problem, build a machine, write a program, device a chip, whatever, that solves the general problem. You're given a number N and descriptions of what is in this guy's store, the N types of tiles, and all you want, don't show me the tilings, don't show me the periods, nothing. Just yes or no. Yes, if I can tile any size living room. No, if I cannot. For the more mathematically oriented people here, the question of whether, given a finite set of tile types, you can tile the entire infinite grid is equivalent to the question of whether you can tile every k by k square. And one direction of that is not trivial at all. Because if you can tile the entire plane, you can tile any size square. But who says that if you can tile any size square, you can put those squares together to form an infinite tiling? That's your homework assignment. It's a nice little mathematical exercise, which I invite you to do. But for me, it's beside the point. It's just two versions of the question. The question is, can you write a program that solves this? And you're given my computer, your computer, Jeremy's computer, tomorrow's computer. You can use any language, any methodology, any technique that you like. As much time as you want for the computation, as much memory, as many disks to write, whatever. And the answer is no. And, you know, I don't like getting up on the table and jumping up and down, but that's probably what I should have done, at least for the sake of people who've never heard this kind of fact before. There's no such thing. Don't waste your time on it. Although the reasoning we went through here sounds kind of mechanical, algorithmic, something that you could probably produce by a machine, you know, looking at possibilities and trying things. In general, this problem is undecidable. Now, sometimes people look at this and they say, well, yeah, okay, I mean, even without seeing the proof of this, they say, well, but it's unbounded. I mean, to say no, you cannot tile, all you have to do is exhibit a certain square of a certain size and show that no possible placings of this finite number of tiles work. That's finitary. But to say yes, it seems to be that you have to somehow go through infinitely many possibilities and build something infinite. And so they say, well, of course it's unbounded. So if it's unbounded, it's probably undecidable, non-computable. And of course, for the mathematically inclined people here, this is obviously not a proof, but it's even not a good intuition. It's a bad intuition. And let me put that, nail that in a little stronger. And so this particular transparency is work that I was involved in several years ago. So here's a slightly different version of the problem. So this is more like real dominoes. You don't want to tile the living room, you want to tile a snake. So you're given 2 points, P and Q, and the same set of tile types, and you want to tile a snake. You want to know if there is a snake going from P to Q. And again, the rules are you have to touch at least one side as you go along, and the sides have to have adjacent sides have to have the same colors. And let me ask you, does this look like a bounded problem or an unbounded problem? Bounded problem is you only seem to need to check a finite number of possibilities. An unbounded one is, what do you think? So the more sophisticated minds here would say, he wouldn't have asked us the question. This is game theory. And by the way, I'd like to take this opportunity to congratulate the two yesterday's Nobel Economics Prize Nobel Prize winners in economics, one of whom is from the University of Maryland, Schelling, and the other is an Israeli, Oman. So the game theoretical thing is, I wouldn't have said this if it wouldn't be the opposite. So you're wrong. So the status of this problem is really interesting because it's completely counterintuitive. This problem is this. Let's start at the second line first. It's decidable if the snakes can go anywhere. So the most unbounded version of this problem is decidable, and in fact, for the technical people, there is a rectangle of dimensions that you could compute from the input, and all you have to do is check that rectangle. If there's no snake there, there's no snake nowhere. But if you limit yourself to say the plane above this line, the problem is undecidable. And in fact, we also, with a little more effort, were able to show that almost any, even the most minute way of bounding the problem becomes undecidable, even if you remove a single point. So you're given P, Q, and R. You want to know whether you can go from P to Q anywhere except go through R. That's already undecidable. So you have to be very wary of using your intuition about boundedness versus unboundedness in order to put things above or below the line. Another example, which is, I think, much more well-known, is the halting problem. This is, I think, my only transparency with a formula in it, or an X in it. So here's a little algorithm. If X equals 1, you stop. Otherwise, you subtract 1 from X, and you go back to checking. I think anyone here who is still awake, of course, realizes that this algorithm halts on 1, on 17, on 155. It does not halt on 0 or on minus 3. It does not halt on 3.5. It does not halt on pi or on e for obvious reasons. So it's obvious that the halting set of this algorithm is exactly the set of positive integers. So is this okay? We're still awake here? Here's a slightly more complicated version. So now let's just talk about integers, positive integers. So if x equals 1, you stop. Otherwise, you check if x is an even number, you divide it by 2. If it's an odd number, you multiply by 3 plus 1, you go back to check. Question, does this algorithm halt on the number 2005? Have you checked it? Does it halt on 2005,355,891? Have you checked it? Okay, so this is very interesting. Let me do this for you for the number 7. So 7 is an odd number. It's not 1, so we do not stop. It's odd. We multiply 7 by 3 plus 1 is 20. 1 plus 1 is 22. We go back. It's even. It becomes 11. 11 is odd. It becomes 33 plus 1 is 34. It's even. It becomes 17. So that's getting a little hard here. 17 times 3 is 51 plus 1 is 52. 26, 13, 40, 20, 10, 5, 16, 8, 4, 2, 1, bingo. So this halts on 7, and the question is, which of the positive integers does this algorithm halt on? The answer is, we don't know. This is called the 3x plus 1 problem. It's been open since the 1930s. It's an open problem in number theory. It interests us because it's a nice problem, but as computer scientists, although this is a very trivial program, and this is a much more profound program because we don't even know what numbers it halts on. We're not interested even in this interesting one. We're interested in the general question, which is, can you build a program or build a chip or write build a special purpose computer even, which will have the ability to take a program in some agreed upon programming language, take a bunch of symbols which are the input to that program, and all we want is for it to be able to say yes or no. Yes, if had we run the program P on the input Q, it would have halted, and no, if it wouldn't have halted. And again, I don't have to say this to the more sophisticated members of the audience, but just sitting there and doing a simulation will not work, because you can simulate and simulate and simulate. If it halts, you halt and say yes. But if you wait for 3 years and it hasn't halted, you're going to say, okay, I'm fed up with this guy. I'm going to go home and say no. And you might have made a mistake. You know, you might have waited just one more nanosecond. It might have halted. So, but that's not a proof of anything. And again, this problem is undecidable. Wrong button again. Sorry. So there's no such W, and the halting problem is undecidable. And I think many people in the audience know this, but I'm not quite sure that you all know that this is essentially true for any question about computation. This is really a profound result. It's called Rice's theorem. And it really says that anything you want to know about computation, as long as it's not a trivial thing, such as does this program have 17 lines, does this program use the variable x, does this program run on this kind of computer or not? That's not the issue. Any issue about computation, about whether programs do what you think they do, whether they're equivalent, whether they run in this way or that way, none of these questions can be decided. They are all undecidable. So this is really extremely profound. In our own profession, we cannot decide, which is the main tool of our profession, about anything we want to know about our own profession. This is really diagonalization taken to the limit. It's despite the power of computing, we can't really tell anything in the general sense of the word about computing. This is really amazing, isn't it? I keep getting.
Can I decide which button?
So I've decided to jazz this talk up a little bit, and I'd like to show you. This is a commercial, but it's not a commercial like, you know, the books I showed you. This is a general commercial. So I'd like to show you a little commercial showing why discovering errors early on is crucial, and it can make a tremendous difference. Just a minute. I'd like to. Can you all see this? That's why I wanted this to be a little more clear. Can you see what's... hasn't started yet, but can you see the car? So, correctness is an important issue. And of course, we all know about the Y2K problem, and the motivation for giving these examples is things like the Y2K problem and questions such as, can we build software to find the errors in programs to figure out whether a program does the same thing on December 31st, 1999 as it would do January 1st, 2000? Can we correct the errors? Can we tell whether programs are efficient? Whether two programs are equivalent? None of these things, in general, none of these things can be decided. And this is kind of a sweeping negative fact. And by the way, most of the things I showed you, for example, the unbounded tiling problem, the half-plane snake domino problem, the halting problem, all these essentially are computationally equivalent, which means that they're not decidable. But if you give me one for free, if I can ask God answers to halting questions, then I can answer snake domino questions and tiling questions and vice versa. In that sense, they are equivalent. But you should know, and this is also some work that I was involved in, that some problems are much worse. Before we read this, let me just say something. What can be worse than a problem that cannot be solved? And so the analogy is, let's say that someone comes in here and does all kinds of contests of hand wrestling, and they come out with a report that says everyone in this room is extremely weak, which is bad, of course. And then they add a footnote, but, you know, the lecturer, he's even weaker. And that means that we're all weak, but when I go against you, you pull me down. So in that sense, there are problems that are not only undecidable, but you cannot even decide them with the help of these other problems, which are themselves undecided. And a striking example is the following. Make the following tiny change in the domino problem, the tiling problem. So you're given a finite set of tile types, and you don't only want to know whether you can tile the entire plane, but you want to know whether you can tile the entire plane such that this particular tile I'm pointing out occurs infinitely often. Now, that doesn't seem to be much of a difference, because if you can tile an infinite plane with finitely many tiles, some of them have to occur infinitely often. But I'm just a little bit insistent. I would like to know whether this one occurs infinitely often. Now, that does not just make the problem undecidable and not even worse. It makes it infinitely more worse on the other, in a sense that I won't get into, of levels of undecidability. So there are infinitely many problems that are all, each one is harder than the ordinary problem, and this is even harder than all of them. Which button was it? So, recurring tiles can be used to solve the ordinary domino problem, but not vice versa. And in fact, our sphere of algorithmic problems, this was the line we had earlier between the solvable, decidable, and the unsolvable, undecidable. There's actually another line in here, which I won't get into, which I like to call highly undecidable. And up here is the analytic hierarchy, here's the arithmetic hierarchy, and other things which I won't get into, but the recurring dominoes, for example, resides up there. And of course, even within computer science, for many people, just knowing that something is above this line is quite enough, and they're not really too worried about what happens later on. Some of us are interested in the really rich and interesting structure that goes on up there. There's also some connections between things that happen upstairs and things that happen downstairs, but into that I definitely cannot get. So now I could stop here and say, well, you know, that's the bad news. There are things above this line, and now let's go home. But I don't want to stop here. First of all, because as Alan said, the ceremony is only at 4:30, so there's lots of time. And the second reason is because the most interesting parts of our story occur down here. But down here, problems are solvable. They are computable. They are decidable. So we have to find a different way of saying what bad is, because things are solvable. And what we will do here, as many of you know, and even those who don't know probably guess, we will be talking about resource consumption. How much time, memory, whatever things take. And so we'll be talking about order of magnitude running time. And I just have to do this pretty quickly. The green here are upper bounds. So if you want to search for a name in a jumbled telephone book, we can do that using binary search in order of log n time. The red is a lower bound, which, you know, using particular set of rules of the game, such as working only with comparisons, you can also prove that log n, order of log n, is the best possible solution that you can find for searching in an ordered list. So this is a closed problem up to a constant. Sorting can be done in n log n. Usually people scream quicksort. The answer is no. Quicksort in the worst case is not n log n, it's n squared. But there are other sorting methods that take n log n. And worst case is an important point here, because both upper bounds and lower bounds here talk about the worst possible case, because as we said right at the beginning, we want our algorithms to work on any given input. And in this case, we want the bounds to work for all inputs. Now, there are problems where maybe my colleagues here from computational linear algebra will make me wiser. Is there a better upper bound than n.239 these days? Anyway, so this is roughly the best bound on the number of multiplications in multiplying n by n matrices, and this is the best lower bound. There is a gap, and again, just to make sure that everyone understands this, a gap here doesn't mean there's some mathematical gap. It means we are to blame. Either the truth is here, or it's here, or it's somewhere in between. When I was at MIT, and this is not against MIT, there were two professors in our department who for about 6 weeks had, one had a lower bound and one had an upper bound on the same problem, but the lower bound was higher than the upper bound. And so one of them was wrong. I won't say names. So one of them was wrong. But upper bounds and lower bounds have gaps. Gaps are interesting because it keeps us busy, people working in algorithms. But I don't want to talk about n squared and n cubed and things like this. I want to talk about much worse functions than that. Wrong button. Must be completely dyslexic. So here's another little break here. So what we're going to be talking about are amounts, quantities, the size of things. And I'd like to show you that sometimes big differences in size can produce quite striking and unexpected effects. So here we go once again. So the size of what you're expecting to fall out of the tree is, you know, is something that we can talk about. It's no big surprises. However, so that was just a little thing about the power of size. And so in fact, now we're going to talk about big cars falling out of trees. And so we want to, I want to show the distinction between a polynomial and exponential time. And this is a logarithmic graph, which means these don't grow linearly and these don't grow linearly. And what happens, of course, is that all polynomials show up as straight lines. This is n to the power 10. Even n to the power 1,000 would be a straight line, but a lot steeper. But exponential functions like n to the n, 2 to the n, 1.2 to even 1.0000001 to the power n would climb up wildly, violently after a certain amount of time. And this shows the distinction. I've also marked here, around here, the number of nanoseconds in one day. And here, of course, this moves up and down slightly depending on which physicist you talk to, but the number of nanoseconds since the Big Bang. So, for example, 2 to the power n becomes much, much, much larger than the number of nanoseconds since the Big Bang when n is, you know, 100 or 100, definitely 128. But I'd like to show you the kind of information that's in that graph in a much more devastating and down-to-earth way. So here is a table that I will expose to you cruelly, one bit at a time. And the story behind this table is as follows. Suppose you have a problem to compute on your computer, and you have four people, you send them off to do their work and come back with algorithms. One comes back with an n squared algorithm, n to the power 5, 2 to the n, n to the n. Of course, the message is going to be that above this is reasonable, is okay, but below this is really bad. And what I've written inside is actual time that it would take a computer to run this algorithm on an input of this size. So number of employees in the University of Rennes, you know, 300 is a very small number. So these are not very large inputs at all. And these are real times based on the assumption of one instruction per nanosecond. Now, if you have a computer that's 1,000 times faster, of course, every single square here has to be rewritten. But as you'll see in a moment, the interesting parts, the differences are. So we start with an n squared algorithm, input of size 20, 1 over 2,500 of a second. This is about a hundredth of a second. This is about a tenth of a second. When you get to this n to the power 5, it's worse. It's 1/300 of a second to start with, a tenth of a second, 7/10 of a second, 10 seconds. Anyone like to guess this? It's not three times as much, of course, because this is not linear. Quick guess, not computation, just guess. So it's about 40 minutes. That's kind of unpleasant. But, you know, you buy a faster computer, you wait a little longer. If it's a crucial thing like computing the average salary once a month, then this is fine. Let's go down to 2 to the power n. Input of size 20, 1,000th of a second. Guesses for this quickly? So 18 minutes, that's not too bad. Quick guess for here. Someone please say something. Not in French, though.
Some years.
36.6 years. And one input of size 100, 400 billion. Now, you know, you can laugh, you can chuckle, but this is not a question of getting, you know, the Google Explorer versus the IBM, the Microsoft Explorer, or moving into Java, or getting an object-oriented, knowledgeable programmer, or working with a visual language, or getting a smarter computer. I mean, this is a profound fact, which says that in the worst case, this is what it's going to cost you to run this algorithm on this size input. This is just a lot worse, you know, 72-digit number of centuries. And all I can say about n to the power n is that things become bad a lot earlier, you know, so. So those are the facts. And so what we're going to do is we're going to add another line here, and most computer scientists agree that this is the line to add, where we call tractable problems that have solutions that run, in the worst case, in polynomial time algorithms, and these are intractable. And in case you wonder about this line, because remember when we talked about this line, I said, how on earth do you dare put a line there? Maybe your computer is different. And then I stood up and I said, Church Turing thesis, all computers are equal. They might take more time and so on. But here, of course, my computer is a lot slower than your crazy 7,891 or whatever. So how can I draw a line here? But again, this is extremely robust. Oops, we'll get to that in a minute. So this line is extremely robust, and we'll get to that in a minute, in the sense that all Computers, all languages, all methodologies essentially are polynomially equivalent. So anything I can do in a tractable way, you can do in a tractable way, and vice versa. And anything you can't, I can't. So this is also insensitive, essentially as insensitive as that, at least as far as we know. I'm probably spending about 15 minutes of my talk just playing with the buttons here. I think my time is running a little short, so I'd prefer to skip this, but there are problems that are provably intractable. This is a strategic problem called roadblock, and there are many other such problems where figuring out a winning strategy is something which is provably exponential. Also chess and checkers, but of course we generalize these to n by n boards because otherwise it's just one a problem with a finite number of possibilities. All these have been proved to have exponential lower bounds, therefore they are provably intractable. So that's this line over here, and robustness follows from a refined thesis which says all computers are polynomially equal. And a surprising and very interesting result of a couple of years ago was that testing numbers for primality, which was not known to be doable in polynomial time, was proven in 2002 to be here, whereas it was not known beforehand whether it's here or there. People always ask me this question: what about quantum computing? What about natural computing? What about DNA computing? Well, I won't get into natural and DNA computing, but if you define them in a particular way, they are essentially equivalent or not no more powerful than the models we have. But quantum computing is something that people ask about. Essentially, one of the reasons is that there is a very famous result of Shor that shows that factoring numbers, which is something we do not know how to do in polynomial time in any classical model, can be done in polynomial time in the quantum model. So is it true that the line between tractable and intractable goes away if you use quantum computation? And I just want to give you two facts about that. Prophecy was given to the stupid, so I won't prophesize here. But two facts you have to know. First of all, this kind of thing has not yet been shown for any problem that's provably intractable in the classical sense. This is only thought of being intractable in the classical sense. And the other thing is, no one has been able to build a quantum computer with more than, I think, 7 or 8 qubits, which are the quantum analog of bits. And there are physicists who say that, you know, you will never be able to do more than a certain number for physical reasons. I'm not an expert. I don't want to say anything on this or on that. But don't rush home saying, oh, all we need is quantum computation and all these problems are solved. Now, I spoke about time. I could have spoken about memory, in which case I could have shown you a problem that requires exponential space in the sense that even on reasonable size inputs of size, say, 150, they would require memory that's larger than the entire known universe, even if you built a special purpose computer to do it and you took each bit the size of whatever, a quark, for example. Now, this part of the story is not complete, and I cannot let it go without talking about NP completeness. We've come so far, we've set all this groundwork, and there are many people in the profession who have kind of a hazy, less than perfect education about what NP completeness is. So let me just tell the story briefly so that at least we get the facts straight here. And this is maybe the most interesting part of the story, and that is an enormous class of problems. It can be between 1,000 and 5,000, depending how you count. Some people count similar problems to be different or to be the same, and they all share the following remarkable properties. First of all, they're all computable, so they're below the middle line in that sphere, but the best upper bounds we have are exponential, so the best algorithms we have for them are very, very bad, are intractable. On the other hand, we don't know that that has to be the case because the best lower bounds we have are polynomial. Actually, usually they're linear. So we don't really know whether they are in the bad area or in the good area of that sphere that we had earlier. And I should have said this before when I showed you that sphere and I put the third line and filled the top with red. I should have emphasized that the line between tractable and intractable is really the most important line in that sphere, because above that, for all practical purposes, at least in the worst case sense, you can forget it. So the other two facts, however, are this, that they rise or fall together. What we do know how to prove is that if you find a polynomial time solution, you find a tractable solution to one of those problems, all of them become tractable. And if you prove that one is intractable, all of them become intractable. So it's like a big castle made of cards where pulling one out, they all collapse, and making one stand, they all stand. And this is called the PNP problem. It's been open for 35 years. Definitely the most important and one of the most difficult problems in computer science. And the first 10 years it was kind of laughed away a little bit by many mathematicians as being something technical about non-determinism in machines. But I think now most mathematicians would agree that this is really a major open problem, even from just a mathematical point of view. So the question is, we know that they're below this line. We don't know whether they're below this line or above this line. And since this is the most profound line, that question, which is open, is extremely interesting. The most interesting thing is they are all here or they are all here. And before I give you some examples, because the real power of this notion comes from the diversity and the richness and the profundity of the class of problems that's in there, I'd like to show you my final little clip here. And that is that what we're saying is that an entire skyscraper can depend on a single foundation. So here's what this kind of thing can really look like. So this is NP completeness, right there. How am I doing on time, Michelle? 15 minutes, okay. I know this is very embarrassing. It's a new machine, though. I had an old one. So here's my first example. Again, a toy-looking example. This is the monkey puzzle. Many of us remember this from when we were children. Some of us remember this from when we had small children. Some of us remember this because we have small children now, and whatever. So this is an N-card puzzle, 3x3. It's reminiscent of the tiling problem, actually. And you're supposed to arrange it into a 3x3 square where the bottoms and tops of the monkeys match and the colors match. So this takes, I think, 10 minutes or 15 minutes, you know, on the carpet to figure this one out. But again, as I said earlier, we are not interested in puzzles. We are interested in the general question. And the general question is, given a bunch of cards, a square number of cards, can it or can it not be arranged in a square? Don't even show me the arrangement, just say yes or no. And this is NP complete. And what this means, by the way, is that when I'm done in about an hour and a half, right, and you walk out on the main street of the city and there's a toy store there, and the guy calls you in and says, come, have a new one of these, 225 cards, 15 by 15 version, just came in from Taiwan, you know, new. Don't buy. Because unless they made it with all white monkeys in the same direction, like, if it has like just one solution or a couple of solutions up to symmetry, you won't be able to figure this out on your fastest computer in a million years' time because it's NP complete. Unless you solve the P equals NP problem, in which case I would gladly give you the podium and the honorary doctorate, and you'll become very rich and very famous. Wrong button. Some other NP complete problems, more famous than this, the timetable problem. I love this one. So you're a high school principal and you have to figure out, you know, you have a bunch of teachers, a bunch of classrooms, a bunch of slots, and there are some constraints. You know, he can teach computer science and physics. On Wednesday afternoon, he can't come at all. Bible, he cannot teach. He can teach music and computer science and control theory. Thursdays, he's out, and he needs a very large lecture room because everyone comes to, and all these constraints. And I don't even ask you for the timetable. Just say yes or no. Can you satisfy the constraints or not? This is NP complete. Remember, not only do we not have a polynomial time algorithm for this. You can buy software that does this, by the way. That software makes errors, I guarantee. I hope the errors are of the good kind, that they don't say, you can never do this, but they say, I need three more teachers and two more classrooms, and then you give it to them, and then they solve it. I hope it's not the other way around. But the thing to remember here is if you can solve this, you can solve monkey puzzle problems. If you cannot solve this, you cannot solve monkey puzzle problems, and the other way around. Traveling salesman, another famous problem. Don't always think of a traveling salesman with a suitcase with, you know, brushes and combs and needles and pins and needles. But think that you've inherited a very large factory from your parents, and it's a integrated circuit factory. And you get this order for 500,000 circuits with 200, and you have to drill 200 holes. And all you want to do is program this drill once and for all to do a short tour through these 200 points and drill the holes. And by the way, notice that I'm giving you here decision versions of this. Don't even give me the optimal tour, just the question of whether there is a tour of a certain length or not. Knapsack problems, summing integers, logic. You want to move, but you're not rich enough to hire a company. You bring all your friends over with their cars and trucks, and you put all the crates on the street. All you want to know is it possible to put all these crates in the cars without violating any of the capacity requirements? And so all these are NP complete. And another question that people always ask is, okay, but maybe these kinds of things can be remedied by approximation algorithms. So perhaps with a traveling salesman, I don't want an optimal solution. I just want something very fast that's guaranteed to be no more than 10% or 50% more than the optimum. And the answer, very briefly, is sometimes, but not always. And one of the deepest lines of research in computer science in recent years has culminated in showing that several NP-complete problems remain NP-complete even in the approximation sense, in the sense that even that if you could find an approximation algorithm to come close to the solution in polynomial time, then you could actually solve the problem. So this is another kind of bad news. And sometimes the bad news can be used constructively in cryptography. Do I really have now just 10 minutes, Michelle? 15. So let me briefly show you the last 15. So let me briefly show you an example of this. I'd really like to do this now. I need some money. So I need to collect about 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 11 small coins if possible. And I promise to give you back most of them. So while you're collecting the money, I really need the coins. Let me tell you the background story. So this is... Assume that I know a secret. This is too big. Thank you. It's worth more, but it's too big. Okay. Oh, this is great. Maybe I should just spend the last 15 minutes just walking around. Wow. I should have asked for notes. So here's the story. Let's say that I claim that I know a certain secret. Just for the sake of the argument, let's say I know what color socks George W. Bush is wearing at this very moment. And if I say that I know this, what's your response? No way. You don't believe me. In fact, what you're really saying to yourself is, you're a goddamn liar. You're a liar. And why is that? Because it's really a secret. It's something that you don't believe I can find out even by making a few telephone calls. And I say, no, I do know. And you say, you don't. And I say, I do. And we argue. And then what do you say? Prove it. Now, what proof would you accept? Here's a proof that you would accept. We make sure all the microphones are turned off, and I say dark blue. And then we call George W. Bush in. We ask him to do so, and to do so also, and you see dark blue. Then what do you say? We're sorry. We suspected you for nothing. You really knew this. And to minimize the effect of just guessing, we do this, you know, 50 times or so, okay? That's fine. The proof is fine. You're convinced. But there's a problem with this proof protocol, and that is that when we're done, not only are you convinced that I knew the secret, but you also know the secret. But suppose I don't want you to know the secret at all. Suppose I don't want you to know anything about the secret. I want you to come away from here not even knowing whether it's a light color or a dark color or a warm, reddy, orangey color or a cool, greeny, bluey color. Nothing. Just the only thing I want you to know that you couldn't have found out yourself was the fact that I knew. This is called a zero-knowledge issue. And you can ask two questions here. One is, who needs that? I mean, usually in life, you want to prove something, show me the proof and I'll be convinced. And this I can give many answers to, but I don't have time. There are many applications where you want to give away only part of the information, not all of it. You know, we want to know what the average salary among us is, but we don't want people to know exact salaries. We want to go into some secret place and put a card in and tell the guard something to let me in, but I don't want him to know who I really am, you know, things like that. The other question you might say is, we will never, ever accept a proof which is not something that you show me and I verify and I know. So I'm going to show you how to do this, not with George Bush's socks, but with a different example. And the example is the following graph. Which machine do I use? Okay. And I claim that my secret is that I can color this graph with three colors, where coloring a graph means this and this can be different colors, but these have to be, these can be the same colors, but these have to be different because they're connected by an edge. It's a little bit like the tiling problem again. Nodes connected by an edge have to have different colors. Now, why can't you just go and check this? Because this is NP-hard to tell whether it's three-colorable. So here I have a 12 or 13 node graph, but if you were to, because you don't have your computers working here, but if you were to bring your Cray 75,981s with you, I would just have a 200 node graph up here, and it would still be a secret. So you can't tell. So if I say I know how to color this, you essentially should start out by saying, we don't believe you, prove it to us. So you say, I don't believe you, and I want to prove this, and now you want to do something at the end of which you say, okay, I believe you, but I have no idea how to do it myself, and I'd like to show you how this is done. So, by the way, some people say, oh, I give chalk talks, I give transparency talks because I'm old-fashioned or I'd like to not sound too modern. Here, I have to use this because what I do here, I simply cannot do using a computer because it won't be with integrity. So I really have to use this machine. And so here is this graph. You can check that it's the same graph. And I really claim I can color this with three colors. And you don't believe me. The problem with this projector, by the way, is that it takes time to warm up. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn this off briefly. Hope it will come on quickly. And I'm going to cover the graph with a coloring. You still have the graph up there, so you can check it's the same graph. But I'm going to cover the colored nodes with coins. So when I turn this back on, you will see the graph, but you will not see the coloring. And I claim that this is colored with three colors, and I will even tell you what colors I'm using for this. I'm using red, blue, and green, and I need a volunteer. I'm not Jegorz. I don't do magic, at least not the way he does, but I still need a volunteer. And so this is the graph three-colored, and I need a volunteer. You're willing to volunteer. So here's what's happening here. I'm not willing to take away the coins because then you'll see the coloring. Also, I'm not willing to take away these. I'm not willing to take away these two coins because I'm not willing to take away these two coins because these two coins connect. These two coins cover nodes that are not connected. And I have the prerogative of doing the same color or doing different colors. And if I show you that, you have a little bit of information about my coloring, so I'm not going to do that. But I am going to ask you, actually, you're not a very good choice because we're friends, and I might have planted you here. The best thing, but we'll do it because of lack of time, the best thing is to take someone I've never seen before, and who's never seen this before, and say, please point to two nodes that are connected by an edge. Let me just straighten this a little bit. And I'm going to uncover them. So point to any two nodes connected by an edge.
Connected.
Connected, yes.
Okay.
So. These two. Are you sure? Maybe these two? No? These two?
Okay. These two, yes.
Okay. So now what you see here is you see that I haven't used the fourth color. They're two of the three colors that I said I was using. And they're different, which is what they should be. So Albert has not yet managed to expose me as a cheater, as a liar. Now, the question is, I should have covered this up earlier. The question is, are you now sure that I can do this and color this graph with three colors? And the answer is no, you're not sure yet. But the more interesting question is, are you a little bit more sure than you were before he came up? And the answer is yes. And I'll tell you exactly by how much. This graph has 24 edges in it. If I'm a liar, he has 1 in 24 chance of uncovering me as a liar by either showing I'm using a fourth color or showing that the two edges are colored with the same color, which I'm not allowed to do. He failed. So your confidence that I'm a liar goes down from 100% to exactly 223 over 24, which is 96%. Now, I'm not willing to uncover any more here, but what I am willing to do is to close this, to take this transparency off, and to put another one on, in which, again, I'm colouring the graph with three colours. I claim it's the same colouring, but that makes no difference. I mean, if I can do it two ways, that's even better. And again, I'm going to cut. You're not supposed to look at this. Actually, you have to sit down. I need someone else now. And now I'm going to expose this once again with someone else. And the colours are different. It's still a three colouring, but I'm not telling you the mapping between the three colours from before and the three colours from now. So you're not going to be able to connect the previous trial with this trial. Volunteer, please. So now I'm telling you that I'm using whatever it is, blue, brown, and purple, and I need, again, a friend. What can I do? So please point to two nodes connected by an edge.
Sure. I'll take those two.
Those two. So we expose them again. I haven't used the fourth color, and again, these colors are different, so he hasn't managed to expose me. Now here comes the crucial point. These two trials, from my point of view, were independent. I had no idea what they were going to do. So the probability I can pass two tests and sweat a little but still not be exposed as a liar is 23 over 24 squared, which is 92%. And we keep on doing this again and again and again. And the probability that I can pass more and more and more tests goes down exponentially. And you can sit down. And the point is, the subtle point is that you get to choose when to stop. So this is a probabilistic algorithm par excellence. You get to choose when you're happy with the result. You come out of here only knowing at the amount of confidence that you're willing to push this forward, that I can do this. You have absolutely zero knowledge. This is provable. You know nothing about my coloring strategy whatsoever, even after 10,000 of these rounds. And by the way, this particular kind of strategy becomes less than 50% after 17 rounds. This is, you know, n minus 1 over n to the power k. There are other examples where it goes down by, you know, by 1/2 to the power k. And so this much fun. And by the way, I do know how to color this with three colors, so I wasn't just sweating for nothing. I'd like to spend the last 5 minutes. I'm skipping quite a bit of stuff here, but I'd like to spend the last 5 minutes on AI because, again, if I don't, people will say, well, computers can't do all this stuff, but can they think? Can they do? So here's something that Dijkstra once said. Asking whether computers can think is like asking whether submarines can swim. So we don't like to use the word thinking for computers, just like, you know, we know what submarines can do more or less, but they don't swim. We know more or less what computers can do. Now we also know some things they cannot do, but it's not thinking. And those of you who are familiar with the Turing test might know a little bit more about thinking and intelligence. Let me skip this and let me just give you an example of a communication between a candidate piece of software that is trying to pass a Turing test and an interrogator in the other room. And so the question here is, what is a Zupchok? And the computer or human in the other room says, I have no idea. And so the person says, a Zupchok is a flying novel-writing whale. It has been carefully cultivated in a laboratory over several generations to ensure that its fins evolve into wing-like things that enable it to fly. It has also been gradually taught to read and write. It has thorough knowledge of modern literature, and it can write publishable mystery stories. And the answer is, how weird. And then the person says, do you think Zupchoks exist? Now, the point, when I continue this, is try to think how deep we have to work to build a computer that can carry out the rest of this conversation. And so this is intelligence. Playing chess is incredible. Now, one day in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, when a computer will be officially the world champion of chess, I'll be the first person to tip my hat. But that's not intelligence. Computers have been the world champions in computing salaries for 50 years, and they're the world champions in many things. So they'll be the world champions in chess. This is intelligence. And so a reasonable answer that you or I might have given would be, no way, they cannot exist, and the question is why. And now you or I or someone with medium average intelligence says, for many reasons, first of all, our genetic engineering capabilities are far from adequate when it comes to turning fins into wings, not to mention our inability to cause 10-ton engineless creatures to defy gravity just by flapping those things. Secondly, the novel writing part doesn't even deserve responding to. It's just so stupid. Writing a good story requires much more than technical ability to read and write. Don't you have something more interesting to talk about? And again, but think about how intelligent I had to be or you had to be to give this response. We just had to know that genetic engineering is more relevant to this discussion than ancient Chinese pottery, about gravity, about literature, about, so many things. And this is it. This is intelligence. And I'd really like to end with three short conversations that take place between a voice on one end of a telephone line and an answering machine. But this is not an answering machine today, it's in 50 years' time. And again, just think of how you would program a computer to deal with these issues. So my answering machine, if you call me now, my office will say something like, hi, I'm abroad, I'll be back on the 16th, please leave a message. In 50 years, if I'm still around, it'll probably be more interesting. It'll say, do you need something? Do you need a copy of a paper? Maybe I can forward something. And it would converse with you. But look at these conversations. The machine says, hello, this is Jim's phone. The voice says, oh, it's you. Listen, this is his boss. I really need to get Jim right away. Can you locate him and have him call me? Machine says, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. His boss. Jim is playing golf this afternoon, and he left orders not to be disturbed. The voice says, he's playing golf, is he? Well, look, I'm thin on patience this afternoon. This is his boss calling you, idiot, not Mr. His boss. Get Jim now. So the machine says, I'm pleased to hear that you're spending time with your patients this afternoon, Dr. Thin. Business must be good. If you want to reach Jim's boss, just dial this number. Certainly you would never find him here in Jim's office. We have him listed under our directory under the alias of the monster. So the voice says, take this message, you son of a chip. Get it straight. Tell him he's not worth the keys on your control panel. He's fired. Click. That did click. Second conversation. Hello, this is Jim's phone. And then the voice says, oh, hello, you darling machine. I just wanted to check that was still on for dinner and whatever. Machine says, of course, Sue. I have you for Thursday at the usual spot. The voice says, this is Jim's fiancée, Barbara. Who is Sue? Now, at this point, the machine starts sweating. And it says, oh, Barbara, I didn't recognize your voice. I've never met anyone, never heard of anyone named Sue. The voice says, but you just said he was meeting with Sue on Thursday. The machine is dripping now. Oh, that's Sue. Are you sure you have the right number? This is Robert Finch's phone. It's a desperate attempt at getting out of it. The voice says, you can't pull that trick on me. Tell Jim it's all over. And by this time, the machine is completely a flood. You've reached an unworking number. Please check your listing and redial. Click. Final conversation. Hello, this is Jim's phone. And the voice says, are you satisfied with your present investments? Have you considered the advantages of tax-free municipal bonds? To hear more, please give your name and address following the beep. Now Jim's phone has never heard anything like this in its life. It says, and then there's a beep. And so it says, this is Jim's phone. And the voice says, thank you very much, Mr. Jim's phone. Now let me tell you more about our unusual investment opportunities. And of course, what's going on? These are two machines trying to talk to each other. So the moral of the story is computers cannot do everything, cannot do anything. And I just want to end this gloomy talk with a beautiful example of what computers can do. I'm just going to leave this running in the background, hoping there'll be no questions that I have to answer. But if they are, I'll be happy to do that. This is an amazing simulation. Sorry, I want to make this a little larger. Just look at how gravity and light and shape are dealt with here. Thank you. I can stop this. Thank you very much.